And I mentioned that tonight we're going to do the Book of Esther. And the Book of Esther is very unusual. It's a very unusual book, according to the in the eyes of the Torah scholars, because we have a Masorah, that is a tradition of the scholars, that states that at the after the Messianic era, there will only be two books that remain holy, and that is the five books of Moses and the Megillah, and all the other books of the prophets will lose their status. And the reason why the other ones will lose their status is because there's another Talmudic statement that says that were the children of Israel on a very high level, they would not have needed anything besides the five books of Moses. So the prophets were only necessary in order to bring out certain ideas that really are contained in the five books, but they're not really brought out enough. And the prophets drew those ideas out to bring it to the people's attention so that they should be able to return to God. But were they righteous, this wouldn't have been necessary. Now, after the Messianic era, it won't be necessary anymore because everybody will be on a high plane, a high level, and a high Torah knowledge level, so it won't be necessary. But the Talmud says there's one book that's going to remain forever, and that is the Book of Esther. Strangely enough, of all the books, one wouldn't think that one. But that's what the Talmud states, and Maimonides states this as well. The question, of course, is why is this so? We understand the five books of Moses, but what is so unique about the Book of Esther that this should be the one book that remains from all the prophets, all the books of the prophets? I think the answer is clear once you really understand the Book of Esther well, and you learn it properly. Naturally, to learn the book properly, you have to turn to the people, the authors of the book, and the nation that that received the exact method of learning the book that was written by its greatest leaders, namely Mordecai and Esther. And the method of reading the book was they were the ones that taught the people how to read the book, and the scholars, and that's how we know how to approach it. So when you approach the book properly, you find that the Book of Esther is unique because of an important thing. And that is something that everybody's always curious about. Everybody that is involved in religion, always curious about, and sometimes people are very presumptuous about, in most religions they're very presumptuous about this, in all religions I say besides Torah they are, and that is the way God works. Everybody has some idea about how God works. Everybody thinks they know how God works. They feel they know how God works. The Torah teaches us that these kind of feelings are not feelings that we should pay any attention to, but rather we should cancel those feelings and learn from God's Torah itself how God works, insofar as man is able to understand it, of course. Now, two frames within which God works. One frame is the framework of the miraculous, and that's in the five books of Moses, the ten plagues, the splitting of the sea, the feeding of the people, God fed the people the manna in the desert, and the various miracles that occurred to the people of Israel during its initiation period. Now, that's one way that God works. That way, really, is something which is not available to every generation. It's a rare thing. It only happens essentially. Certain events would never be repeated, as the Torah states, with the event at Sinai would never happen again, because God does not like to break his laws of nature, the laws of the universe. He only did so in order to establish the people, but it was not meant to the Torah taught people to relate to God through the Torah itself once the Torah was established, not to try to relate to God through the miraculous. We don't search for the miraculous. And the miraculous is not available to many, 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 many generations. Only it's a very rare occurrence, a rare event. But that the Torah does teach us how God works in the world, in the realm of the miraculous. But there is another realm in which God works, and that's the realm that he works with on a constant basis, not the miraculous. but behind the scenes, how God brings about certain events in history, and how he operates behind the scenes in the throughout the history of the world. And this is portrayed in the book of Esther. Now, the main thing when approaching, and that's why I believe the answer to the question I raised before, why the Talmud states that this book will always be with us. That's part of the answer. Because this book shows us how God works within the realm of the normal. And also, in doing that, it shows us that God works in conjunction with people. And how precisely he works in conjunction with people. And in what manner. It also teaches us, while it's doing that, since it involves the people, it teaches us how perfected people operate. Because it's showing us how God interacts with humanity and what actions people can do to bring about a favorable relationship with God. Okay. So with that introduction, I'd like to approach the book of Esther. And I would like to approach it, of course, through the eyes of the Torah scholars. Because the Talmud states also that the book of Esther was written for exegetical purposes. Which means that the Torah, as you know, was written in a very special style. The style of the Torah is that a child can read it and gain some knowledge, some ideas. A simple person can read it. But also it's written in a way that if you look carefully at the wording, you'll see it points to ideas that are between the lines, and that's the exegesis. And when they wrote the Megillah, when the Megillah was written, it was written in the same exact manner as the Torah. So it was written on two planes, the simple plane, and then also it was written for the purpose of reading between the lines. It points, if you look carefully, you'll see more. The deeper, the greater mind will be able to draw more out of the Megillah. So the Megillah is the book of Esther. So I'm probably going to use that word again and again. I might as well tell you. So let's take a look at how the rabbis direct us to understanding this book. The rabbis tell us, first of all, that during that time, there was an amazing thing happened, and that was that Jews returned to the Torah and reached a level of fulfillment of the Torah that had not even been reached at Sinai. And that's based on the book of Esther 9:27, because it states that if you look at that verse. And this is one of the methods of exegesis, is when the Torah wants to point out something to you, one of the ways it does it is it uses a word that doesn't quite fit in properly. So the casual reader won't notice the discrepancy. But the one who is sharp will see just a moment, that word is not the precise word. And he'll see there's something else that it's pointing to. And the Talmud states that this verse says, in Hebrew it says, what it means is, I don't know what your translation is, but in Hebrew it means they fulfilled and the Jews fulfilled and accepted upon themselves and upon their children and upon all those who were attached to them, which means the proselytes, to make these to make these 2 days as it is written every year. Now, the first word is really out of place, because the first word states they fulfilled. It should say they accepted upon themselves. Fulfilled doesn't belong there. So these two words, kimu v'kiblu, in Hebrew, the rabbis say what it means to say is that they reached a state of fulfillment here, of Torah, that they never had, even at Sinai. Because at Sinai, there was a certain measure of coercion that took place. Because after all, seeing that awesome spectacle at Sinai, and the revelation at Sinai didn't really leave people with too much of a chance to say, well, look, maybe we shouldn't accept the Torah. It was too awesome and overpowering. But over here, that's one of the problems with the miraculous. The miraculous overpowers a person, and therefore the total personality, the normal personality, is suspended, And that's bad, because what the Torah wants is that the normal personality should be related to God. If you remember, the greatness of Moses is that Moses is the greatest of all prophets because he relates to God in the normal state. And as the Bible says, that other prophets relate to God and when they're asleep in a vision, they're not conscious. They cannot be conscious, because if they're conscious, there's too much. They are too distracted. And in the state of prophecy, they must have all their energies wrapped up in the prophecy, and they cannot be conscious. But Moses was the only one of the prophets, the greatest prophet, who could relate to God even while he's in the normal state. And the fact that he was awake did not detract from his energies, and he was able to relate to God nevertheless. So the Torah always aims at a person serving God in a normal state. When miracles occur, the person is, his normal state is kind of disrupted and suspended, which gives him a temporary response. Then when he comes back to his normal state, he really isn't quite up to par. He's not quite up to the level that he reached when he was under the influence of the miracle. That's why a miracle really is only a temporary thing. It doesn't really improve a person in a permanent way. It can only be done like a shock treatment, to shock a person to into certain points of knowledge. But then he's got to take it from there, and if he doesn't, the miracle is completely worthless. So over here, the Talmud explains that the Jews reached a level at that time where they fulfilled the, there was a new, like a new acceptance of the Torah. They accepted upon themselves and they fulfilled the Torah on a plane, on a level that they had never done before, even at Sinai. So that means that there must be something quite amazing here in this Megillah that teaches a person how to serve God on a higher level, even, than the event at Sinai. What exactly is this? Okay. Now, if we let's take a look again, as we did before, in verse 26, with the same method of approach. If you take a look at that verse again, you find the verse is pointing to something which is strange. I mean, it. And whenever I said it, that's one of the ways of knowing something's going on beneath the surface, when you have these phrases or words that just don't quite fit in. Now, it says like this in verse 26. Therefore, they called these days Purim because of the lottery, and therefore on all the words of this letter. Okay, fine up to there. But now it says like this. And what they saw about this, and what happened to them. Now, what does it mean, what they saw about this, and what happened to them? What do you mean, what does it mean, what they saw about this? So here the rabbis step in and they say that this verse is pointing to the most important part of the whole Megillah. And the verse is saying as follows. And I'll just read you the statement of the rabbis first, and then we'll analyze it and we'll show how it fits into the verse. But let's just take the statement of the rabbis just verbatim. Okay? Just hold on 1 minute. Okay, the Talmud states as follows. It says, what did they see about this? So the first thing the Talmud says is, what did Ahasuerus, that was Ahasuerus, you remember the king, what did Ahasuerus see that he used the vessels of the Holy Temple at his feast? Okay, and then it says what happened to him? What did he see, and what happened to him? In other words, they're breaking up the verse into two components. What did he see? What did he see because of this that caused the certain thing to happen to him? So they said like this. What did Ahasuerus see, the king, see that he used the vessels of the Holy Temple at his feast? If you remember, the Megillah opens with a tremendous hedonistic feast. And the rabbis tell us that he was using the vessels of the Holy Temple. So what did Ahasuerus see that he used, caused him to use the vessels of the Holy Temple? And what happened to him? He killed his wife, Vashti, the first wife. Okay? And then the Talmud says as follows. What did Haman see that he became envious of the people of Israel? In other words, he decided to kill them. His hatred was kindled against the Jews. And they say, what was it? It was because of Mordechai. Because Mordechai would not bow down to him. And what happened to him? What happened to him was that they hung him and his sons on the tree. Okay? And then they say a further one. They say, right. They say, what did Ahasuerus see that he brought before himself the books of the writings? He asked them to bring the book of the history of his kingdom. And the reason was because of Esther. Okay? Because Esther actually was the one that told him, that had that first, that invited him to the him and Haman to that first party, and right. So and because of that, what happened was that the result was that a miracle occurred and the people of Israel were saved. Okay, and then the last one is, what did Mordechai see that he refused to bow down to the to Haman, and what was the reason why he refused to bow down to Haman, and the reason was that Haman was really pronouncing himself as a god, and Mordechai refused to accept that, and what happened to him was that he was that the miracle occurred, and of course, as you know, he was he actually became the head of the household of the king. Okay, so let's just, that's the statement of the, that's basically more or less the statement of the Talmud, but let's try to just analyze it a bit. What the Talmud is saying really is that the whole story of the Megillah revolves around four personalities. These four personalities are Ahasuerus, the king, Haman, the wicked, and then you have Esther, the queen, and Mordechai. And the Megillah is really a study in these four personalities and how each one of these personalities, when you study them carefully, you'll see what they were and what resulted from their, and what really resulted from their from these from their character traits. Okay, now let's take the personality of Ahasuerus, and let's see what we can understand about him. Ahasuerus basically was a hedonistic king, as you know, and you see that he had this tremendous feast, and the first part was a feast for 180 days. And then he had the next feast that he had was the feast for the people in the city of Shushan for 7 days, all right? And the feast was, the way he had this this feast, he was a very liberal kind of a fellow. You get the feeling he was like a jolly kind of king, but which is true in one sense. He was very free. It says they didn't force anybody to drink. And it says the vessels were different. This, what does it mean that the vessels were different and didn't force anybody to drink? It means that he was a man that did not like any kind of ceremonials. He was not a person that was given to proprieties. He was not a man of propriety. He was not a person of etiquette. See, when you have etiquette at a meal, so people drink at certain points, you know, this is, well, now's the time for a toast. And then also you have to have the sets, your sets of dishes. You have different sets of glasses and dishes, and everything has its own use. And, you know, in a very sophisticated society, etiquette plays a big role. And Ahasuerus was really anti-etiquette. That's why he says you drink as you see fit. I don't care. It's up to you. You're here to enjoy yourself. And vessels, we don't have any sets. There's nothing here. They just take out all the vessels and whoever, just use whatever you want. He was anti-etiquette. What he really wanted was basically indulgence in the physical without any restrictions. He was anti-restriction. Now, There is a little an interesting piece of insight here, by the way, on the in Esther 1 verse 8. It says that it says, and the drinking was according to the rule. There was no forcing, because this is the way the king would always set up the rule, impose it on those of his household to do according to the will of, it says, ish for ish, which means a man and a man. So again, the rabbis say that, why does it say the word man twice? So the rabbis say, this is to teach us that Ahasuerus had two main people in mind, and that was Mordechai and Haman. In other words, already he recognized that there were two people in his kingdom that caught his attention, and they interested him. And the entire feast, behind the entire feast, the main thing to him was to impress these two people. That's a very, very true thing about psychology, that a person can make a very big dinner, elaborate event, and many times, in the back of his mind, there could be one person that he's doing the whole thing for. And even though on the surface, in a conscious way, he might even deny this, but in the back of his mind, one person could be more important than everybody else. That's human nature. And in this case, the Talmud explains to us that Ahasuerus was really, in the back of his mind, what he wanted to do was to impress these two people. He considered them both great people. Mordechai impressed him, and Haman impressed him. Now, let's get back to the... okay, now, one of the things that he did at this feast was he took out the vessels of the Holy Temple, and he used them. And the Talmud even says that he made a calculation, because he knew about the 70-year thing, that after 70 years, the Jews claimed they were going to go back. And he made a count, and it came out according to his count, that 70 years were up, and the Jews were not going back. And therefore, what the prophets were saying about the redemption of the Jewish people was completely false. And he was very satisfied that his account was correct. And he was so happy that he took out the vessels of the temple and he used them at his feast. Ahasuerus, why did he use these vessels? This is a strange kind of a thing. If he was a hedonist, so he just didn't believe in it. Again, the Torah gives us amazing insight. What the Torah teaches us is that many times people do things in order to prove that they are right. In other words, they act out certain fantasies in order to make sure that what they think is, what they feel is true. And really, what the Torah is teaching us is that Ahasuerus, in the back of his mind, was a little bit afraid of the prophets. He was a little afraid, maybe they're right, maybe there's something to this. In order to prove that they must be wrong, he took out the holy vessels, and he said, we're going to use this for our pleasure at this orgiastic feast. And that proves that there's no God, because God would never allow such a thing to happen. And it shows us that this whole thing is a complete myth, and there is no God, there is no Israel, and we could just have our own pagan way of life and be very happy and secure. So again, the Torah gives us amazing insight, and this is insight which we could use today. And I have seen many people, for instance, in the name of science, put up certain arguments. And evolutionistic arguments, or various different arguments. And when you read them carefully, you see between the lines, biblical critics, you see between the lines, there's a little bit of fear there, and they're trying to prove that they are right, because they're concerned that maybe there is some truth in the Bible. And they will go out of their way to try to convince themselves, really. A person can write an entire book to convince himself more than others many times, and just as in the case of the feast. You have a big feast, but in the back of the person's mind, it's for one person. Same thing is true here. What the Torah is teaching us is that Ahasuerus, even though he was a person who was hedonistic, paganistic, but in the back of his mind he was a little worried. And taking those vessels of the Holy Temple, you see, was a way to prove to himself that this whole thing is a myth. God would strike me dead if he were here. And since he doesn't, and I use these vessels, that proves there is no God. I have nothing to worry about. My way of life is perfect. So that's the reason that he did it. He was trying to deny, really, the concept of sanctity, that anything could be... sanctity, you see, what does sanctity mean? Sanctity means, in the Torah, it's not a Holy Spirit on something. That's another paganistic concept. In the Torah, sanctity means that there could be that a person has to recognize that there are certain things that exist not for his instinctual pleasure, but for a higher purpose. And he must refrain from using them for his instinctual pleasures. The main law about the Holy Temple is what we call in Hebrew Isser Hana, which means that the main thing is that a person is not permitted to use anything in the temple for his own personal enjoyment. Why is that so? It's to teach man that everything that exists is not there to satisfy his instincts. There is a higher purpose in life, and he must be able to say no when it comes to the instinctual at certain times. Ahasuerus did not like that idea. That's why he used the vessels of the temple, because his philosophy was that everything is for his enjoyment. That's the purpose of everything in the world and everyone in the world. Now, that's what the Talmud says. What did Ahasuerus see that he used these vessels of the temple? And what happened to him that he killed his wife, the queen, Vashti? What is the relationship, the correlation between those two? Well, now maybe we can see it a little clearer. What it means is like this. Ahasuerus, by using the vessels, he was trying to show there's no such thing as sanctity. Everything is here for my pleasure. Now, what happened next? Next, he insisted that his wife appear at that feast, and as the rabbis explain, why did she refuse? Because he wanted her to appear naked. You see, it says, of course, the Megillah doesn't say it openly, but it just says, to show the nations her beauty. So the Talmud explains that it meant really to display her beauty, her entire physical beauty, which means that she should appear naked to show everyone what a beautiful wife he has. And that's that was the whole idea of the feast, if you remember, to show and to demonstrate to others what his greatness is. 180 days to demonstrate the greatness and the power of his monarchy. So what happened was he made a little transition. From vessels, he went to people. And he wanted her to appear there, which was for his purpose, and it was, of course, degrading to her. And he didn't care because she only had one, the people to him only had one purpose, was to serve his instinctual needs. So she, on the other hand, she got a bit upset about that. She, the rabbis tell us, came from Nebuchadnezzar. So she was really aristocracy. He was not. He was a general, Persian general. And he married her because he admired the fact that she was aristocracy, and it sort of gave him a certain sense of legitimacy. And the rabbis tell us over here that, the Megillah itself says that she refused. It doesn't say what happened to her, but it's pretty obvious, again, if you read between the lines, that she was killed. Now, there's an interesting dialogue that took place that the Medrash says. Tells us that it says you take a look carefully at the verse where it describes this. That's in Esther 1:12. It says, and the queen Vashti refused to come at the word of the king, which was in the hands of the hands of his servants. Okay, and it says, and this is the part I'm getting to, the main part where it says, The king was very angry, and it says, and his anger burnt in him. So the rabbis ask, they say, there again, this is one of the methods that the Torah uses, and which was copied by the writers of the Megillah, that what the Torah does is, sometimes it repeats, and when repetition is always a new idea. And the scholars say, if you look at this verse carefully, he says, and the king got very angry. There's nothing more to say. That's it. He got angry. Well, you can't talk any more about it. Why does it say, and his anger burned within him? So the rabbis explain there are two kinds of anger. You see, there's an anger that a person can get angry at something, but then there's another kind of anger, a worse anger. Like, for instance, if someone embarrasses you, and you can't do anything about it because of social reasons, so you burn inside, internally, with anger, but you're unable to express it. That is much worse. So the rabbis say there were two things happened here. He was very angry at her, one, and two, there was a burning anger inside him that he couldn't express. Now, what brought about that anger? So the rabbis explain that she was so angry, she was so upset at his request, because she realized that this request is just making her into an absolute zero, just a pawn, an object to be used by this king, and by the king, and she was from aristocracy. She just would not put up with this. So she sent him back a message.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We got to change tapes.
Okay. So she refused to comply with his wishes. Now, she was making a statement, really. Her statement was that I am not an object of your use. I mean, get this wrong, my friend. I come from aristocracy, from Nebuchadnezzar, and you're just a commoner who happened to take over because he was a powerful general. But you don't know anything about being a king. And she even told him, she insulted him, and she said to him that my grandfather's horsemen, who would take care of the horses, they could drink and never get drunk. You have had a few drinks, and you're talking like an individual is completely drunk. And that's why you're making this crazy request. So she didn't just refuse, but she put him down, and she put him in his place. And basically what she said to him is, I come from aristocracy, my friend. I know how to handle, I know how to be a queen. And you are just basically a bum that gets drunk at his parties and makes these crazy, ridiculous requests of people. That's how she refused. So it wasn't just refusal. Now you take a look at the verse. The verse is very beautiful. It says the king got very angry. That's because she didn't obey his command. But then his anger burned within him. That was because of the insult that she used to deny him his request. And that he couldn't respond to that. He was just insulted, and he had to linger with that burning anger. And that's why we understand a little better that what happened was over here that he, if you remember, when he asked his advisor, what do we do in such a case? And then they told him, they said Memuchan, which was actually Haman, the rabbis tell us, but he had a different name before. And the name was different because his character was in a different state at that time. But it was really Haman. Now, what Haman suggested was, if you remember, he said not only did she sin, the queen not only sinned against the king, but she sinned against everyone. Because she is setting a very poor example. Take a look at verse Esther 1. Verse 16. So Memuchan said before the king and his servants, not only did the queen Vashti sin against the king himself, but she sinned against all the princes and all the important people in the land and all the nations, because now they're going to say now women are going to degrade their husbands. It was a question of women's lib. And they're going to say the king demanded that Vashti come, and she refused. And that was precisely because what Haman pointed out to the king at that time was that this is not just a refusal. Basically, what she is saying is, I am not an object of your use, but I am on the same level as you. This is not tolerable. Haman said, this is not tolerable. So now we have, in other words, what he said was, this is not an individual case. This is a political problem over here. We have a problem of a philosophy being born with this refusal. It's a way of life that we have to put down immediately, and that was his point. And Haman was a very bright person. He was a very intelligent man, and you see that immediately that he thought in universal terms. With ideas, he wasn't just a simpleton, and that's where people make a mistake when they read the histories of the past. They think that people are simpletons. People are very intelligent and very bright, even brighter perhaps than people today in a lot of ways. At any rate, this is what he did. He told the king that this is not just a personal affront here. We're dealing with a whole philosophy that's being spread by this refusal, and if we don't stamp this out now, we're going to have problems. So therefore, he suggested she be put to death, basically, and that's what happened. Now, it's very interesting, while I'm going, I mean, it's, once we get involved here, it's very hard for me to stop. But if you take a look at verse 13, in Esther 1, verse 13, so it says, and the king said to the wise men who know the times, and the rabbis say, what does it mean? And then look at the end of the verse. It says, because this was the way of the king before all those who know about custom and law. And what does that verse mean? So the rabbis explain as follows. Who are the people that knew the times? What does it mean to know the times? The rabbis say that's always a reference to astronomical knowledge of astronomy. And the Torah, if you take a look at Deuteronomy, the Torah mentions about the fact that this will be your knowledge in the eyes of the nations. And the rabbis say that's a reference also to astronomical knowledge. And as you know, the Sanhedrin had astronomical knowledge. They had tables, because in order to sanctify the new moon, you have to know astronomy. And they had all the calculations of how when the moon will, you know, when the new moon starts. And they studied astronomy in general. That was a part of the study of the Torah. And if you take a look at Maimonides, there is a whole section on astronomy, because in order to know how the holidays work out, you have to know astronomy, and it's very, really, really very advanced mathematics. But the Sanhedrin had to engage in that kind of a study. That was part of their study, because of the you know, the new moon and of the holidays. And besides, the Talmud shows from the prophets that it is a mitzvah, it is a good deed, a commandment for a person to study the universe as well. That's part of Torah as well. So the scholars, all scholars, and many, even medieval scholars, I mean, always try to study mathematics and astronomy insofar as, you know, insofar as they were capable. Their main preoccupation was always Torah, but they were always up to the knowledge of their times in all the fields of science. So the rabbis say that the ones that he asked, the ones who knew the times, that's a reference to the Sanhedrin. He went to the Sanhedrin, Ahasuerus, and the rabbis say that this man had a very good trait, very fine trait about him, and that was he would always ask before he did something. He was not arrogant. He was not crazy arrogant. He was not a type of person that thinks he knows everything. He was not a fool. Now, you have to understand, to run a kingdom, you cannot be a fool. And he may have been arrogant in one way. He liked to show off. He was, you know, very exhibitionistic. But in another respect, the rabbis say he had a very fine character trait here. One of his fine character traits was that he would always ask people that had knowledge. When he saw he had a problem with the queen, he didn't, even though he was angry, and you notice that, now that's a high level. He was very angry. He could have just said, you know, off with your head. But he didn't do that. He said, just a second, I have to be careful here. If I make the wrong political maneuver, because even a king is dependent on the people, I have to have people loyal to me. Every king is only, he may be a monarch, but he can be a monarch vis-a-vis one person or several people, but not vis-a-vis the whole kingdom. Otherwise, he'll get overthrown. So he was an intelligent fellow, and he would not make a move before he asked his advisors, even if he was overcome by emotion, which is a very high level. That's why the rabbis say this man had a very good trait. Now, he went to the Sanhedrin, the rabbis tell us, and that's what it says. The end of the verse says, because this was the way of the king before all those who know customs and law, custom and law, which means whenever he had an issue of a custom or a law that he wanted to establish in his kingdom, he would always ask advisors. Would never do anything just out of hand. So he went to the Sanhedrin. The rabbis say the Sanhedrin listened to his problem, and they said to them amongst themselves, we can't answer this man, because this is a catch-22. Whatever we say, we're going to be in trouble. If we tell him to execute the queen, so then now he's drunk at this party. But he probably is very strongly attached to her. And then what do we do if after he sobers up and a few months go by and he decides that that was a big mistake? Why did he kill her? Then he's going to come after us, okay? On the other hand, if we tell him not to do anything, so then again, if things go wrong in the kingdom or because of this issue, certain other issues come up and she rebels more or whatever, then he's going to blame us because we didn't give him any proper advice at the time. So the rabbis and the Sanhedrin decided that we don't need this honor of being advisors, and then we're going to lose either whatever we do. So they told him, they said to him as follows. They said, you know, we used to have a lot of knowledge when we had the temple, and then we even would deal with issues of life and death because according to Torah law, under certain circumstances, you have to execute people. And we would deal with those issues, which are very involved, and we have to study them very carefully. But since our temple was destroyed, we have not really been involved in this kind of a thing. And we don't have the proper knowledge to determine life or death anymore. So they asked them, please, you know, ask somebody else, because we really can't help you on this issue. And they did it because they realized that they would be in trouble. On the other hand, you see the personality of the Haman, he jumped at the opportunity. Because he was a person whose very essence is ego, and this was a person whose essence is ego is always eager to advise. That's the greatest ego. Take my advice. And you'll see people who acquire large amounts of wealth, usually always in their immediate circle, to those who are dependent upon them, they're always big advisors, at least to their face. They're always considered big advisors, because down deep a person recognizes that the only thing great in man is knowledge. So even though he may have a lot of money, he doesn't want to walk around and having people think, well, he's got a lot of money. I don't, he does, it's just money. They want to think, no, I got this money because I'm intelligent and I know everything, so therefore these people become big advisors. And they jump at the opportunity to give advice. The rabbis used their wisdom and they jumped back at this opportunity. But Haman jumped right in there. This was just perfect. Not only did he jump in, but he said this is a philosophical issue. And we have to, and he made a whole issue out of it. And therefore he advised the king. And the king apparently liked his advice. So at this point, it looks like the rabbis were wrong, because he said execute the queen, and he explained why, and it looked like everything's going along nicely for Haman at that point. Okay, so that explains the what was going on actually in the setting of the first chapter, and that explains about the gives a little insight into the personality of Ahasuerus, and we'll see a little later more about his personality. But now let's take the second personality. The second personality is the personality of Haman. Now, what is the difference, really, between a Haman and between Ahasuerus? And we have to ask a question, too. We know that Haman was anti-Semitic. He wanted to destroy the people of Israel. Was Ahasuerus anti-Semitic or not? Now, on the surface, when you read the Megillah without any looking into it, as we said before, between the lines, you'd say, well, not really. As a matter of fact, you see here, he asked the rabbis, so apparently he wasn't really anti-Semitic. But it's very interesting. You find that Haman, when he made the suggestion to the king, when he saw that Mordechai would not bow down to him, so then he made the suggestion to the king that the king should destroy all the people of Israel, all the Jews that existed in his kingdom. And if you take a look, it says in Esther 3:8, and Haman said to Ahasuerus, there is one nation which is scattered among the people. Every word here, by the way, was for a reason. He said, for instance, he says that they're scattered among the people. So what was the reason that he said that? Because he wanted to, he knew that a king to wipe out a segment of his population is not a good idea for the kingdom, because after all, it decreases his subjects, and that's not what a king wants, to increase his subjects, not decrease them. So the rabbis say he chose those words very carefully. He says these people are scattered, so no one's even going to notice when they're gone. It's not going to make a it's not really going to it's not like destroying a province where you have like a what the rabbis refer to like a bald spot in the kingdom. They're spread out, so no one's going to know the difference anyways. And then he said, he says that their laws and their laws are different than any other nation, and they don't really do the laws of the king. And it is not fitting for the king to allow them to exist. The rabbis say that he gave a few examples of that. Of course, as you understand, the Megillah can just give you on the surface the basic outline. But obviously, the man didn't just come in and make this one statement, and then the king decided to kill the Jews. This was he had lengthy polemics going on for a long time. And one of the things that he mentioned was that got him angry was he says that even they said to him that even if a fly falls into the cup of wine of one of these people, they throw the fly out and they drink the wine. But if you, my master the king, touch that cup, they'll throw that cup of wine on the ground. They won't drink it. You of course know the reason for that. That's because the rabbis passed a ban on drinking wine wine, or actually it's really a Torah law. If an idolater takes a cup of wine, one of the things they used to do was they would take a cup of wine, and they would make a toast to their god. And the way they would do it would be they would shake the cup. Talmud explains this. It's hard to understand today. You got to picture yourself in those days. And some of these customs are hard to understand or trace back. But that was one of the things they used to do. They used to shake the wine. So once wine is used for idolatrous purposes, you're forbidden to partake of it anymore. So that's why the rabbis extended a ban, and they said that any time an idolater touches a cup of wine, you're not allowed to drink it. But according to the Torah law, if it's only not drinkable if the idolater really used, like he shakes the wine and makes a libation over it to his god. So then it's something that was used for idolatrous purposes, you're not allowed to drink it. Now, that's why any Gentile that touches wine is, you know, and it's a big problem. We have that problem at the at the Seder. At the Seder, as a matter of fact, my students ask me this question very often, because the law is not just with regard to a person who is an idolater or a Gentile. The law is with regard to a Jew, for instance, who doesn't keep the Sabbath. It's the same thing. The Torah is never prejudiced. People only think that it's prejudiced. The Torah is very, very fair, very even-handed. And according to the Torah, a Jew who does not keep the Sabbath has the same status as an idolater, because the Sabbath is the day in which one is supposed to recognize that God created heaven and earth. If you don't keep the Sabbath, that means you don't recognize that. Now, that's tantamount to idolatry. You don't have to actually have an idol, but the denial of God is the same thing as idolatry. The person denies God's existence, he is considered immediately an idolater. It doesn't mean you have to have another little god there. Just an atheist is an idolater also. Same category. So therefore, a Jew who does not keep the Sabbath, if he touches wine, then you're not permitted to drink it. And what happens is many times at the Seder, people invite relatives, and some of the relatives don't keep the Sabbath. So the problem is, you're passing the wine around, and as soon as the wine hits that person, goodbye, you can just throw the rest out. So there is a way, there is something you can't do about that, and that is that law does not apply to wine that was cooked, because they would never use cooked wine for those kind of purposes. See, cooking wine in those days, and even today, I understand, by people who know something about sophisticated wines, really good wine is never cooked, because once you cook it, you ruin the flavor. And real expensive wines are never cooked, but inexpensive ones are. So any time wine is cooked, it was considered like not. Once you cook it, you're making it into like a food already, and the idolater wouldn't use it anymore for his libation to his gods. So therefore, cooked wine doesn't come under that ban. So the simple solution is at the Seder to use wine that was cooked, so that in case a person who is not a one who keeps the Sabbath touches it, then you don't have any problem. But now over here, what Haman did, and this is what's done exactly today, the same thing, and I know David knows this very well, what Haman did was he went to the king, and he said, these people, if a fly falls in the wine, they just sort of fly out and drink the wine. But if you touch that wine, they can't drink it anymore, which shows you how they hate you and what an abomination you are in their eyes. Of course, it was really strictly a matter of halacha. As a matter of fact, if a ben Noach touches the wine, you don't have any problem, because a ben Noach is one who accepts the seven laws of Noah, the God, and the Torah, so there is no problem. So you can have if a ben Noach is at a Seder and a Jew that doesn't keep the Sabbath, you have to be careful. The one who is running the Seder must be careful that not for the ben Noach. Ben Noach is fine, but the Jew that doesn't keep the Sabbath, if he touches the wine, he can't drink it. So in reality, the Torah law is always very fair. It has nothing to do with whether the person is Gentile or Jew. It has to do with idolatry. But the king, of course, Haman didn't present it that way to the king. He just presented it in a way that the king was sure that this is a people that are prejudiced, arrogant, and they think they're superior, and if I touch the wine, they'll throw it out. So this kindled his hatred. But, of course, the Talmud is just giving one example. You can be sure there were many more of the same type. What it's trying to show is the way that anti-Semites use to distort Torah and to create hatred towards the people of Israel and towards the Torah and ultimately towards God, really. So I think David knows this very well from some of those periodicals that go around where they they take these statements from the Talmud out of context, and they try to show, to demonstrate that the Jews, the Jewish people, or the Talmud and the Torah, its way of life is is racist. You see, is racist or anti-Gentile. Which is, always absolutely false. But if you take something as Haman did, that same method is being used today. Exactly the same method. That's what's beautiful about reading reading the holy books, when you read them in depth, you see all these things are very timely. They all still exist because human nature human nature has not changed in the last 3,000 years. And the study of human nature is leads you to an understanding of people then and people now. Okay, so that was the way Haman worked his anti-Semitic plot. But if you take a look, what did he say in verse 9? He said, if it's good for the king, we should have it written, the decree should be written to destroy them, and I myself will give 10,000 pieces of silver, okay, for those who, on behalf of those who are going to do the work, to pay them. And then he says very wisely, he says, to put it in the treasure chest of the king, which means he knew that the king, you know, he was obviously overpaying him, and he knew the king is going to, he offered the king a tremendous sum of money, which would be more than ample, and the king will disperse, you know, whatever little bit he has to, whatever, in order to pay the people that are going to be involved in the executions. But many of them probably do it willingly, and the rest will be able to keep. So the king answered him. In verse 10, it says, and the king took off his ring, and he gave it to Haman. All right? And he gave it to Haman, the oppressor of the Jews. And he said to Haman, the money is given to you and the nation to do with it as is good in your eyes. Now you'll notice, if you look carefully at those two verses, you see that the king not only did he not object to this, but he was a little happy about it too. Because two things. First of all, he gave him back the money. He said, don't even give me the money. Money's yours. That's it. Which shows an excitement, a willingness to do it. And secondly, he took off his ring. Now, what does taking off the ring signify? That's an interesting thing. Why do you have to take off the ring? But taking off the ring signifies an authentication of a movement. He actually gave Haman like a power over a whole new project. And he took off his ring. It means the ring signifies the power of the king. Because you see later, when the decree was reversed, so then it says the king took his ring off and he gave it to Mordechai. The giving of the ring is a delegation of authority on a very high level. And he's placing him as a very high authority over this new campaign. And it was more than just destroying people. It was really a campaign and a whole new philosophy. And it was a whole wave of a new kind of thinking which involved destroying a segment of the king's subjects. Okay, see, when you read it carefully, you realize that things aren't done simply now or then. To wipe out a nation is not an easy thing, and it takes a lot of things coming together. Now, one of the things that came together was that Ahasuerus himself was very happy. He was very happy about it. Why was he happy about it? And the reason is he was obviously himself. He didn't like the Jews. You see the way he took the vessels of the Holy Temple, correct? And he used them. So he was anti-Semitic too. When Haman came up with this plan, he joined hands with him. He was very happy. As a matter of fact, the Talmud tells us that Ahasuerus was an evil man from beginning to end, which sounds surprising at first, because you think of Ahasuerus as being a kind, jolly king, who at the end really, is good to the Jewish people. He hangs Haman, and Esther is queen, and everything seems hunky-dory. But the Talmud says, no, he was a wicked man from the beginning to the end. And he says that's why the Megillah ends with a statement that Ahasuerus placed a tax over all his subjects. Because a taxing king means a bad king. It means taxing is always slavery. When a king levies taxes, it means he's using his subjects. That's why the Megillah ends with that verse. It wants to show you that this man, Ahasuerus, don't make a mistake about him, he was not a good man. He was an evil man. As a matter of fact, during his time, it was an economic depression, the Talmud says. And no doubt Haman, that was one of the things, by the way, that Haman used. He said their laws and their customs are different. And he blamed the economic depression on the Jewish people because he says they're always having holidays. Every now and then they have these holidays, these week-long holidays, and Sabbath, and then they have the new moon, and they always have reasons not to work. And this is causing people among the nation to be lax, and it breaks down an industrious spirit. And they're part of the reason why you're having an economic crisis. That was another argument he used. But as I said, he used many, many arguments, and you don't just get a king to destroy people simply. But what the Megillah does indicate is that Ahasuerus was extremely happy and joined in with Haman at that time. Now, However, obviously, there was a tremendous difference between the personality of an Ahasuerus and the personality of a Haman. Now, Haman, as you remember, according to the Talmud, is considered Amalek, right? He was an Amaleki. And the concept of Amalek, really, is not a nation. Doesn't mean it's not a genealogical nation. It's an ideological nation. When the Torah says you must wipe out Amalek, that does not mean a specific genealogy of nation. This Rabbi Chaim Brisker, you know, the Rabbi Salvation Grandfather, explained it. What it means is any nation that has the ideology, its main ideology is to destroy the Jewish people. That is Amalek. In other words, Hitler, Nazism, was Amalek. The PLO, terrorism, is Amalek. Amalek is any nation that has a certain ideology. That's how we identify that nation. So over here we have Haman, who is the head of Amalek, and he wants to destroy the Jewish people. And then we have this other king who also joins with him, also hates the Jewish people. But obviously they took two different courses. And it's important to understand how they differ psychologically and why they have different results. Okay? You see, they both were egoistic. Both were egocentric people. And the pagan is always egocentric. As a matter of fact, the pagan god is an egocentricity, because the god is only created to satisfy the pagan need. That's the only purpose of the god. That's what the idolatrous god is. The idolatrous god is simply something to serve the needs of the person, of the people, persons, or people who make up the god, because they want control of the rain, they want whatever the particular needs are. But it's a functional need. Now, Ahasuerosh was an egoistic person. He was exhibitionistic. And Haman was egoistic. Haman was morbidly egoistic. As a matter of fact, what destroyed Haman? What destroyed Haman was one person. That he, the king, as a matter of fact, as I said, when the king gave his ring, it was a whole new level of delegation of authority to Haman. Haman became a supreme leader. What, as a matter of fact, Haman really became the philosopher of the kingdom. You see, Ahasuerus was the political head, but Haman was the...
Rabbi? Yeah.
Okay. So Haman was the political head. I mean, sorry, Ahasuerus was the political head. Haman was the philosophical head. And these two personalities joined hands together in one plan. The thing that destroyed Haman was when the king said that when the king appointed Haman, if you remember, he says everyone has to bow down to Haman. That showed also that again that Ahasuerus appointed Haman to he raised his position, and he made him a leader, a tremendous political philosophical figure. Okay, I think we're gonna have to stop here.
Okay.